All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 7th day of January 2020. And as this is the first broadcast in 2020, let me wish all of you a joyful, prosperous, and happy new year. Before I talk more about today's show, I always like to remind you that I write a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can subscribe to that by going to miningstocks.com. And we like to put in a little plug for Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? It's chenpicks.com to sign up for Chen's letter. And Michael Oliver, who we'll be talking to in just a minute or two, it's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com for his very prescient views on the markets, as you will see, and we'll be talking to him, realizing how well out ahead he is of most of his technical analyst peers. Well, we do want to thank you for listening to the show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. We also want to encourage you to continue sending along whatever comments you have. Send them to questionsfortaylor at gmail.com. Questions, the number for Taylor, at gmail.com. And, of course, we want to thank our sponsors, because without them, we would have no show. Our sponsors for today's show, we have two new ones, actually, Lion One Metals, and I'll be talking to an officer with Lion One Metals, as well as Quentin Henning in just a few minutes. Also want to welcome Sitka Gold Corp, which is a new sponsor to this show as well, and we'll be talking to them next week. An exciting new story, and you should realize that the companies that are sponsors of this show have first been added to my newsletter. I want to have sponsors on this show that I'm confident in and bullish on their prospects as well. And that is certainly true of all the sponsors that we have. In addition to Lion One Metals and Sitka Gold, existing sponsors are Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Great Bear Resources, Gatling Exploration, and TriStar Gold Resources. This week's guests are Alistair McLeod, Michael Oliver, Dr. Quentin Henning, and for the first time, Amish Gregg. He is of Lion One Metals. Alistair wrote in his December 26th essay titled Bond Worries and Gold that, and I quote, "Treasury bond yields may continue to rise, exposing the debt trap the U.S. government finds itself in. Market participants don't realize it yet, but the global monetary system is spinning out of control. This will become obvious as the crisis stage of the credit cycle now upon us becomes evident," end of quote. Well, Alistair believes that the outlook for monetary inflation is dire. Indeed, it was recently reported that 90% of all U.S. Treasury borrowings since September had to be funded by the Federal Reserve in order to avoid market crash-inducing interest rate increases. So it's hard to think of a more worrisome but still bullish picture for gold as measured in U.S. dollars, and I will be asking Alistair to help us understand how the dynamics of our current global debt problem is leading to debt problems and a financing insolvency for our government and how that might affect other markets. The fact that gold is honest money that holds its value over long periods of time, while every fiat currency ever created has been thrown into the dustbin of human history, that's the reason that I am a gold bug. And as a gold bug, I'm naturally interested in companies that discover the yellow metal and can make a profit from mining it. So I have written about a number of these companies in the past, and I'm very, very pleased to have with me today to talk to Dr. Quentin Henning, who really alerted me to the Lion One story, and that's when I added it just recently to my newsletter and made sure that I picked up some shares as well. So we'll be talking to Quentin Henning and Amish after the first commercial break, but right now I'm really pleased to tell you that Michael Oliver is back with us. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
It's really good to be back, and it seems like this is a year that may be quite exciting for those that are ready for it, and perhaps quite disturbing for those who are not. You've been talking last month or so, maybe longer than that, about two very quiet markets, namely the dollar index market and the commodity market as measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Index. And you suggested that those two markets are very close to a major turn of great significance, even though they've been kind of slumbering, sleeping, and not many people too concerned about them. Where do those markets stand right now, the commodity market and the dollar market? Do you see them making some major changes this year, some major changes
yes.
in direction?
Absolutely. They did it December. The mm-hmm. December close broke below on the dollar index our long-term momentum support structure that the dollar index had used all during 2019. The number adjusted each quarter. So the lows in 2019 aren't the same on a price chart, but on the momentum chart, they were all at the same level on the oscillator. That came out with the December close decisively. Therefore, we argue that the dollar is now shifted into downtrend. Now, it's not making any headlines at this point, but it's likely to make headlines soon. Meanwhile, at the same time, the Bloomberg Commodity Index broke out upside. Again, also a very quiet market. It's been quiet since 2016. And so nobody's paying attention to these two beasts, but they're big markets and they're major. Now, we think also their new trend direction will put wind in the sail of gold, which didn't need their help over the last year or two, but now has the assistance of those two markets to fuel its fire. I caution everybody that the events that just occurred that sparked action out of oil, a dollar or so rally, it had already come up nicely recently anyway, but also caused gold to shoot up $40 the other night in the electronic market, up to 1590. Right now we're trading in the 1570s. But when news events like that occur, quite often it creates confusion, expectations, sometimes false moves. In the case of gold, I don't think it's a false move. It just got a little ahead of itself based on that news. And naturally, there were sellers up there, $15.90, $40 up on the day. And it backed off $20, $30. And now it's firming back up again. So don't be disturbed by the pullback. It was, you know, an emotional moment, but in the direction that gold was already headed. Now, had gold been in a bear trend, which it's not, it's technically in a bull trend, such a rally should have been sold into. But in this case, the rally was legit. It just got a little too hot too quickly. Now, what I really like I'm seeing out there now is the stock market, because I think that's the next player as far as asset class movement that will help generate more upside in the gold market. The stock market is saying, beating its chest, saying, we don't care about that news. We're in good shape. And so, again, the sentiment level of the bulls, the forever longs in the stock market, has to be at about maximum, because they had this event and yet the market did not go down. So they think they're invulnerable. It's our view that probably the S&P is making a top right about now. I'm guessing, and this, again, we haven't broken our numbers, but we have some specific layered numbers below the market that will indicate that, in fact, it is rolling over. But I suspect it's going to make its high, either made its high last week above 3250 on the S&P, or might make a new high this week, but watch it very carefully, because I think if you roll over from these levels, there's a good chance you're making the top. And there's a lot of trigger numbers below the market that are not that far below that will do a lot of technical damage. It's not necessarily apparent on price charts, but it's apparent on momentum charts. And if we upset that market, what will be the response of the central bank? Well, we know what the response will be. More of the same, except even more. We even have a president who wants to print, print, print. So combine that with the ECB, the Fed, and the BOJ, and you've got nothing but pro-printers out there. So that's going to help what? I don't think it's going to help the stock market. It'll flow, it'll create a river of liquidity, but the river of liquidity this time will go into the gold market, is our argument.
So, Michael, the issue here then is if money starts to flow out of the equity market, I suppose it also really goes into the treasury market. But at what point in time, I mean, we're going to be talking to Alistair McLeod in the second half of this show today, and he's really concerned that we're going to start to see rising interest rates, no matter what the Fed does.
I think the only threat of being short of the bond market or expecting higher yields is that at moments when the S&P has sharp declines, you know, mini crashes or a crash type event, you will have the natural panic of investors rushing in to buy T-bonds. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have an upside spike or a drop in yields. But the damage that has already been done to the bond markets, I'm talking the Japanese, the German, and the U.S. government bond markets over the last few months, argues to us that we are probably in transition toward higher yields, with the caveat that if you ever get a moment of a dark moment in the stock market, especially its emotional one, you will have a rush back into T-bonds, but it will be a flare rally in the T-bonds, not a trend-changing rally. I think the bonds have a problem. Yields are going up. And that will leave one asset category out there, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Gold. Gold and the monetary metals, probably
and
silver, too.
Metals. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And maybe to a lesser degree, copper and some of the other metals. I mean, you're seeing a bull market over entirely over the commodity markets, right? That's what you're seeing now.
If you're a smart investor and you look at the, just look at the charts, you've had the commodities beat off the page as of 2016. They haven't gone down since then. They've gone sideways, Bloomberg Commodity Index. So they're not a bear. They're a sideways market. In our view now, they're up. But if you're a value investor and you want out of the stuff that is a bubble, you look over at the commodity category and you see no potential probably for downside risk. The issue is, are they ready for upside? And we argue they are.
All right.
So I think smart money is making the move already.
All right. Well, it certainly is shaping up for a fascinating year if you're long on commodities and gold, that's for sure. Thank you very much for being with us. Michael, we have to leave it go at that. We have to go to break, but thank you so much, Jay, for being with us, and we'll do it again sometime soon. Thank you so much. All right, folks, we do have to go to break. Don't go away, though, because Quentin Henning and Amish Krieg, he's the vice president of Lion One, will be with us to talk about that company's really exciting story in the Fiji Islands, exploration, gold exploration story. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Henning and Amish Krieg.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Gatling Exploration is aggressively expanding its 100% owned Larder Gold Project with three high-grade gold deposits located along the prolific Kirkland Larder Break in Ontario, Canada. 35,000 meters of drilling is underway and to date has now connected two of the three gold deposits and is aiming at connecting the third to create a 4.5-kilometer trend. Gatling trades under GTR on the TSX Venture and GATGF on the OTCQX. Visit www.gatlingexploration.com to learn more.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really glad to have with me for the first time Amish Greg, as well as Dr. Quentin Henning, who's been with us many times in the past. But this time he's not going to talk about Novo Resources or Irving, who two companies he's spoken about in the past, but he's going to help us understand a little bit more about Lion One and its fascinating gold exploration development project in the Fiji Islands. Lion One is a new sponsor to this show and a company that I have personally purchased shares in and have added it to my newsletter after I learned about this exciting exploration project taking place in that part of the world. The company, I think it's pronounced Tuvatu, project in the Fiji Islands, is certainly one I think you're going to want to keep your eyes on if you are an investor in this sector. Before I say hello to Hamish and Quinton, just should tell you that Lion One trades in Canada under the symbol LIO. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under the symbol LOMLF. 117.5 million shares out, or something about that number anyway. Earlier today, trading in U.S. money at $1.32, giving it a market cap of around $155 million. Well, thanks both of you for joining me today, Hamish and Quinton. I'd like to start out first with you, Amish. This is your first time on the show, and you are sitting in for Walter Burkhoff, who is the CEO and chairman of Lion One. It was his vision, but you've been with him, I think, for something like 10 years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Wally's got a knack for putting together really interesting mining assets. He's done it a few times before. And we could count this as maybe the fourth venture that has gone forth into the public markets. The ones prior to this, Northern Orion, Miramar, and La Mancha, which had an aggregate acquisition price of about $3 billion. He's averaging about $1 billion per takeout in his history up to date.
Yes, he's had a very colorful, a very successful history, which, of course, is where we like to start, with people who are successful, that's for sure. Can you give our listeners a little bit more of a history of Lion One? It's located in the Fiji Islands, as I said. This project is a Tuvatu project. What was it that Wally saw there that attracted him? I mean, obviously, there's some other major projects in the area, but fill us in with what he accomplished to date in terms of land acquisition and the progress on the project.
Well, yeah, Fiji, you mentioned it, it's a mining jurisdiction, not on everybody's radar, but the fact is it's got one of the oldest and biggest gold mines in the South Pacific. The Emperor Mine, or Vatukoula, has been in operations for over 80 years, and if that was discovered today, that would be considered a major discovery. They've produced over 7 million ounces there, and there's no indications that that system is constrained in any way. They're still mining it at 1,200 meters depth. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's what brought Walter to Fiji was the chance to own Vatukoula and all of its assets. So this is about 10 years ago, and in the development pipeline of the Emperor Mining Company was a deposit about 40 miles away from this giant deposit at Vatukoula called Tuvatu. Mm-hmm. And it had a feasibility study already done on it. This is at a time when Ivanhoe was Emperor's largest shareholder. So it was available, and long story short, Walter purchased the assets of Emperor, but turned around and sold the operating mine, but kept Tuvatu. Because of the upside and because he looked at it as another chance to start a Vatukoula-sized project without 80 years of history behind it, a chance to build something new. So the last 10 years, the major things that have happened is to have got all the permitting finished. It's fully permitted for production. And most significantly this year, we consolidated the land position around the existing resource, which is something that no other company has ever done before, which gives us not only the Tuvatu resource, which is only a small piece of the overall Navalawa gold system, but an opportunity to explore that area and develop it on a regional basis. And so that's the exciting part, is that for the first time, this is the first time this project has ever been on a district scale explored for the first time, and there's been some notable companies through there in the past. So I'd say that's our chief accomplishment to date.
No, and just perhaps for those who aren't familiar with the story, what is your resource and what sort of grades? And you did an economic study. Could you give us a quick overview of those metrics?
Yeah, well, the relevance of the previous study is that it was done at $1,200 gold. There was a 52% IRR on the resource. So the mine, the part that was identified for mining, they looked at about 350,000 ounces to be produced over the first 6 years, with grades around 11 grams. But that was only talking about the Tuvatu resource, which is a small sliver of this overall system. Mm-hmm. And that only incorporates resources to about, I don't know, probably max depth of 350 meters, somewhere around that. So it's a very small mm-hmm. channel of the project that's been drilled to the point where it could be included in a resource estimate. And so now we've got over 7 kilometers of strike to put together into our exploration program, and that's the most exciting part. So it showed positive economics at $1,200 gold, but there's no indication, like Vatukoula, that the system is constrained at depth below the existing resource or laterally across 7 kilometers or 5 miles of the surrounding caldera.
Wow, amazing, scale, I would say. Before we get to Quentin, I want to ask him about the geological prospects here that he sees and one of the reasons he got involved with the company. But, you know, you noted that you have permits to go into production. Is this something that you envision this company doing, or will you be exploring aggressively, or both?
Well, both. It's a bit of a dual-track strategy, and one of the things we've got is a government that is very pro-mining. The jurisdictionally, this is a you know, this is part of the old British Empire, but Fiji has been pro-mining for many years, continues to be pro-mining. And so they are actually encouraging us to advance towards production. That's the general expectation. So it's a bit different than a lot of other places where this government actually is promoting foreign investment, and they see mining as a cornerstone of their growing economy.
Yeah, all right. Let's turn to Quentin. Quentin, how long have you been aware of this this prospect, the potential for this project? Yeah. I know that you've been scouring the globe for gold mining opportunities, and in many, many years you worked with Newmont in the past, but how long have you known of it, and what has attracted you to this Tuvatu project?
Yeah, let's put it this way. Tuvatu was on my short list. I'll give you a little history. I've been following the company really since they started. You know, they kind of hived this off and started the company about roughly 10 years ago. I've been watching them, you know, step by step, because the geology of this particular project intrigues me. I grew up in Colorado. Here in Colorado, we have a couple of very big alkaline gold camps. Mm-hmm. One is just next to my house here. It's not too far away. And then Cripple Creek, which is in southern Colorado, you know, is a 29 million ounce system. It's still producing. Newmont operates there. These alkaline systems, man, they're big. You know, anybody that knows me knows I like them. I drilled Springpole for Gold Canyon. We readily hit 5 million ounce resource there. You know, and I look at these as they're scarce as hen's teeth. Okay, they're very unusual systems, but once you find them, they tend to deliver. They tend to produce. So, put it in perspective. There's a handful of these things around the planet. There's Cripple Creek here in Colorado. There's the Porgera deposit in New Guinea. Mm-hmm. Again, plus 20 million ounce. Let's see. There's in the neighborhood of Tuvatu or Fiji. There's also the Newcrest mine on Lihir Island, which is a very, very young, in fact, it's still forming alkaline gold system. But all of these things are plus 10 million ounces. Even the nearby Vatukoula mine, it has a resource in, mined and, reserves of over 10 million ounces. So, mm-hmm. When you find these things, you got to treat them very, very gently, very carefully. I'll give you a little background, like Porgera. They started working there. I think Placer started drilling in 1976. It was something like, I think, 1987 when they finally, the picture kind of congealed. It took them like 10 years of pretty intensive drilling. Well, uh-huh. Look at Tuvatu. I mean, that's where Wally is at right now. They've been working there for nearly 10 years. There was some work on the property by Emperor Mines prior to that. But really, it's starting to come together, starting to crystallize. So You know, because I've watched it and because I got to know Wally early last year, I decided to help. It's also an easy stop for me on the way down to Australia. In fact, I find it a joy because I can adjust to the time zone a little easier as I stop. Uh-huh. You know, it's a system I know. It's a system I really like working with. You know, I talked to Wally about my vision, you know, as far as it being an alkaline gold system. It's a little different than many people view it. You know, they were thinking, oh, this is an epithermal deposit. It'll, you know, the grades will die out very quickly at depth, blah, blah, blah. It's not true. These things go down, you know, hundreds and hundreds of meters, probably go down a kilometer or two easily into the crust. You know, so the potential here is huge. You know, already, you know, like Hamish just said, the thing is, say, 350 meters vertical profile on average. And the system has 1,000,000 ounces. So, you know, it's already got like 2,500 to 3,000 ounces per vertical meter, which is very robust for a deposit. You know, so it's easy to see that the system should carry on at depth. We can easily add ounces below the existing drilling. But now, you know, one of the key things we've done is we've, you know, through consolidating the property, we've been able to start exploring the bigger caldera system. And we did bleg work. You know, if anybody wants to, you know, get in details about bleg sampling, the stream sediment sampling, but we had a news release back in November about that. It just lights up. You know, you can see gold coming out of multiple drainages in this caldera, you know, comparable or better than coming off the Tuvatu drainage. So in my view, there's a lot of upside here. The system is roughly the same scale, same kind of scope as any of these very large alkaline systems. And I see no reason it shouldn't host a much, much larger gold system. And I'm hoping that we'll find something on the order of at least 10 million ounces.
As I understand it, the company is drilling four drill holes beneath the existing deposit.
Things evolve. You know, that's where we started back in September when we kind of first announced we were going to, you know, undertake this program. I brought Wally to Cripple Creek, actually, and we went on a tour. I have some friends at Newmont who showed us the 3D model for the deposit and, you know, showed how extensive the veins go. And I think Wally was impressed by that, so he agreed to a four-hole commitment, you know, four deep holes. But look, the gold market's starting to pick up. Our share price has done well. We've just completed a raise about 6 or 7 weeks ago for $11.5 million. We now have a lot more horsepower, so we're looking at expanding that. I would say, you know, we'll be drilling holes, deep holes on an ongoing basis. It's not as though we're going to stop at four anymore. I think we're looking at a more robust program, and we're also looking at these new targets. We've done, like I said, the bleg work that just lifted up the place. You know, it's like, wow, you probably can't swing a drill without hitting something in some of the drainages. And then the other thing is we've done some geophysics, which we haven't gotten together yet, but we'll have it together very shortly, and that'll show, you know, there's a lot of structural evidence that the system's very prolific at depth. So we got a heck of a lot of targets to test. You know, this is one of those things I see, you know, a very hot story, very, very good story to tell in an uptick in gold market. High grade. I mean, good grief. How many major companies, you know, have high grade deposits like this? And it's very hard to find these things. You know, like every single major mining company has an alkaline gold system. Jake, okay, Newmont has Cripple Creek, Newcrest has, you know, Lihir, Barrick has Porgera. You know, but these things, they're scarce, and when you find one, they tend to be high grade, tend to be prolific, and they are very, very highly sought after.
Yeah, and so here you have a company with 155 million market cap, U.S. money, that has this. And let me ask you, Quentin, I presume then what you saw in that first drill hole that's been reported underneath the old the existing deposit, you saw what you liked and what you saw there points in the right direction?
Yeah, I see that we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to hit this hard. Okay, what I saw in the lowest intercept, this is the one that was a little over 4 meters of a little over an ounce per ton. The style of mineralization was different than what you see up higher. It showed a lot of brecciation, which is basically broken rock, okay, that's been healed by, you know, hydrothermal fluids that have brought up other minerals and kind of cemented everything together, including gold, okay. What I see, though, is that is strong evidence of overpressurization event below that level. And what that means is that, you know, the volcano, the basically the magma down at depth, released a upwelling fluid that had a lot of gold in it. And I think from that point below, we're going to see some very high grades and hopefully very good continuity. The thing's kind of forming a trunk, so to speak. And that's what I saw at Fosterville when I first went there. The stockwork and the intensity of things was really picking up. And, I'm hoping it's a completely different system, but, it's similar, formational process. So I think this thing's going to pick up with depth.
All right. Hamish, before we conclude this, I would like to ask you, when might we start to see some more drill results coming out? The first one was released. When might we expect to see some more results?
Well, we've got results from the second hole pending, and those will be augmented shortly by the CSEMT results. That's the geophysics. So that's likely to illustrate where we like to drill next in the caldera to the north of Tuvatu, but certainly we're awaiting results from the second drill hole in Clinton's program, depth below the existing resource at Tuvatu, so that's exciting.
Let me catch up. We're still drilling that second hole. Okay, it's about 600 meters.
Okay,
on holiday break, and there was a bit of a cyclone last week. I believe they've started drilling again. Okay, they'll finish that hole. What Hamish is saying is that we've already, started to assay some of the upper part of it. So we'll probably have some news on that. But, this is going to be a developing story. We're looking at beefing up the drill program, maybe additional rigs in 2 to 3 months, things like that.
All right. So within the next month or so, we might see some results. Is that likely?
Touch wood, yes.
Okay. All right. Yep. Very good. Well, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you, both of you, for helping our listeners understand this very exciting story. I hope we can have you back again when you have some more news to talk about. So thanks so much for being with us. All right, folks, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away. Alistair McLeod will be with us to talk about why he's concerned about the bond markets and what that may mean for gold. Very bullish story on gold. Alistair will explain why he thinks that's the case. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Alistair McLeod.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer, wholly-owned Dixie Project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District. Having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete their very active 90,000-meter drill program through next year. Considered one of the best performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years, GBR aims to release a maiden resource in early 2020. To stay up to date, visit greatbearresources.ca.
TriStar Gold is a gold exploration and development company listed on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol TSG and on the OTCQB under the symbol TSGZF. The large and growing gold resource at Castelo de Sanos project is located in mining-friendly Pará State, Brazil. A recent $8 million investment from major mining company Royal Gold will advance the CDS project towards a feasibility study in 2020. TriStar Gold enjoys strong institutional shareholder support from groups like Gold 2000, RBC, Sun Valley, and U.S. Global.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions4taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Alistair McLeod. He is a senior fellow at Gold Money Foundation and head of research at Gold Money, and his weekly essays are posted at goldmoney.com. They are a must-read if you really want to understand not only what is happening, but why it's happening, the underlying dynamics that make it happen. And that's important, I think, because if you understand economics, and I think largely from a Austrian point of view, which is what Alistair pretty much employs in his think process, in his thought process, I think it can help you better understand what is likely to head your way in the future. So thank you for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
It's always good to talk to you. And I want to ask you, primarily, I would like to focus on an article you wrote on the 26th of December, Bond Worries and Gold. I would also want to get into what you think is in store for gold this year as well, because you've written about that, your first piece in the new year. In your introductory remarks on your in your December 26th piece, you wrote, you stated that the one that talks about bond worries, you talked about the tech. I'd like to, before we get into that, I'd like to just mention, before we get into your views on that article, I'd like to just mention that Michael Oliver seems to reflect your views pretty much in terms of the direction of some of the key markets. Michael is really looking, his technical analysis is suggesting that we have turned the corner in a bear market to, into a bear market for the dollar and into a bull market for commodities in general. He's very bullish on on gold and silver, but he comes at it from a different vantage point. I think it's always interesting when you have people that see things alike but from a different perspective. But in reading your December 26th piece, it seems that you are addressing two areas of concern. One is liquidity concerns in the dollar-based global monetary system, and the other is a lack of foreign buyers in U.S. treasuries to fund what is a growing deficit. The United States projected to, I don't know, anywhere from a trillion to $1.5 trillion a year need to be funded, that is, new funding needs of the treasury. So I'd like to start out by asking you, maybe address some of the liquidity concerns that you talked about in your article. And as I understand it, they're sort of related to what are deemed to be systematically important banks and Basel III requirements. Could you get into your concerns about liquidity?
Yes, certainly. This is manifest, really, Jay, with the repo market in America, which we can see continues to be extremely tight. And I think I'm right in saying that either yesterday or today, there's something like bids for repos of another $90 billion or something. I mean, there's huge, huge amounts needing to be rolled over. And of course, we're now in the new year. And originally, the thought was that the repo crisis was a year-end problem, and it would disappear after the year-end. It's still with us, and it's telling us that the global systemically important banks, the G-SIBs, which have to have enough reserves to cover 30 days commitments going forward, they're running into problems. And the problems basically are that they're trying to finance two things. They're trying to finance the requirements, if you like, for an economy in terms of bank credit. And at the same time, they're trying to finance hedge fund speculation, which basically is shorting the yen and the euro in order to buy the dollar, so that the hedge fund picks up the interest rate differential. So, you know, it's all sort of ended up with a bit of a crisis. Now, the way it obviously gets unwound is less bank lending. And whether it's less bank lending to domestic U.S. corporations or whether it's less bank lending to the speculators and the hedge funds, we have yet to see. Certainly, if it happens that it's less lending, less availability through the repo market, because the hedge funds use the repo market as well for their activities, then that does lead to a tendency to sell the dollar and close their positions against euros and yen. So I think Mike Oliver's point about a weakening dollar, you can see on the chart there is a loss of momentum, certainly in the dollar, and that could develop further if this liquidity crisis continues, which it seems to me it will.
So the repo market is settled down now, I guess. I take it from the at this point in time, right? Does it seem like it's things have settled down?
No, it hasn't. The point. Originally, they were saying, everybody was saying that there's a year-end liquidity problem. And yet the year-end has passed. And now we've still got a repo problem. There's a shortage of liquidity in the system. And the level of repos is still running at a very, very high level.
All right. So that's not very assuring to the Federal Reserve and other central banks, I suppose, because they've been shoveling lots of money into the system and it's still not fixing the problem, apparently.
Well, that is correct. And when you bear in mind the massive explosion of the quantity of bank reserves following the Lehman crisis, I mean, here we are admittedly 10 or 11 years later, but you would think that there's so much liquidity in the system that this problem shouldn't arise. Yet it does.
All right. So we move on to the other issue, the major issue that you have, and that is even if that was resolved, and it's not, you're telling us, even if that was resolved, you have a bigger issue or, say, a longer-lasting issue, and that is how does the U.S., how on earth at current interest rates does the United States finance $1 to $1.5 trillion of new borrowing needs every year?
Absolutely. The problem, basically, we can frame it like this. Normally, a government which runs a deficit would issue bonds, and those bonds, if they are issued on a non-inflationary basis, should be bought by savers. In other words, there should be savings in the system sufficient to pick up those bonds, to invest in those bonds. Now, obviously, it takes investment away from the commercial sector, but nonetheless, on a non-inflationary basis, that is what you need. We do not have that. In America and also in the UK, the level of savings is actually derisory. And most consumers don't save anymore. If anything, they draw down on credit. So we don't have the savings. So what has America been doing? Well, for the last 20 years, every year there has been a budget deficit. It has been matched broadly, which the theory says should be the case, with a trade deficit. And the surplus dollars that end up in the hands of the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Germans and everybody else, all those surplus funds should be reinvested back in America. Now, that way, you have a stable dollar, and the U.S. Treasury finds that it has funding. The origin of that expansion, if you like, of money that ends up abroad is itself inflationary. But it is less inflationary, perhaps, than a situation where the Fed just prints the money and gives it to the government, which is more or less what quantitative easing is doing. Mm-hmm. Quantitative easing also has the advantage of, injecting capital into the banks in the form of reserves. So you kill two birds with one stone. You fund the government and you fund the banks. But it's all inflation. And this is now what is happening. I mean, repos or QE, it really doesn't matter. What's happening is that the Fed is having to pump money into the system to stop it falling over. Now, the foreigners, basically, because global trade is now contracting, partly as a result of the credit cycle turning and partly as a result of the tariff war between America and China, mm-hmm. you can see that the funds are not going to get recycled to finance that increasing budget deficit. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office reckons that this current fiscal year deficit will be over $1 trillion. If I am right, and we are heading into a global recession, the effect on the American economy is likely to drive that deficit, that budget deficit, up to the other figure you mentioned in mm-hmm. your preamble of right. $1.5 trillion. So, right. This is the problem. It's all going to be done on printed money or printed credit from the banks, one way or the other.
Yeah, well, and we've gotten used to that. So a lot of people are saying, what's the big deal, Alistair? What's the problem? I mean, for the longest time, it's been said that we've been able to live beyond our means, Americans have, because of the kindness of strangers. That is, foreigners are, been willing to buy our treasuries. I think you touched on some of the issues of foreign trade, the tariffs and that sort of thing, sort of reducing trade, and so the flow of dollars back into treasuries. Are there some geopolitical issues, too, though, it seems, that might be in play, as well as the funding needs of, well, the biggest creditor nation was China. Can you comment on some of those issues, those dynamics that may be coming into play that are going to make it more difficult? I mean, I saw that somewhere, I think in your article you mentioned August of last year. I think I saw since September up until the last months of 2019 that 90% of additional U.S. Treasury borrowings were financed by the Fed. So where does that leave us? I mean, what are the geopolitical issues that may be coming into play that make this, are causing a tectonic shift here in the global markets?
Well, we have the problem, if you like, even before we consider geopolitical issues, because the key point is that with a contracting economy, people do not need to own so many dollars. And I'll just give you some figures which will put into context. Foreign ownership of assets in U.S. dollars and in America, a total around about $24 trillion, of which about $3.5 trillion is deposit money in the corresponding banking system. If you look at the Americans' investment in foreign jurisdictions, their investments total around about $11.5 trillion. Now, that's a lot less than the $24 trillion that the foreigners own in U.S. dollars, one way or the other. Now, if you look at the bulk of that investment abroad, the liquidity side of it is actually in dollars. In other words, this is a situation where Americans will lend money, say, to Malaysia, but it'll be a dollar loan. There's no currency situation as far as the Americans are concerned. There's just a loan risk. The total amount, looking at the tick figures, the total amount of foreign obligations denominated in foreign currencies is only $92 billion.
Billion dollars, yeah.
Yeah, billion dollars. That compares with the foreigners having $3.5 to $4 trillion of dollars. So, you know, when the global economy slows and money starts to go back to home, guess what's going to happen? The dollar's going to go down. So coming back to your basic question, and that is the geopolitics, the Chinese have played a game, I think, of not being provoked. They have made some very bad mistakes. I think they made a very bad mistake over Hong Kong. Really, they had no need to try and introduce those extradition laws and give the Americans the excuse to attack the lack of democracy in China. So, yes, they have made mistakes. But by and large, their approach on this is not to rock the boat and just let the American dollar hang itself. The Russians, I think, are probably more aggressive. You can see that in their reserve policy. They basically ditch every dollar they get and turn it into physical gold. The Chinese, they sort of tinker around the edges a little bit, you know, maybe giving a little bit of a signal here, a little bit of a signal there. But really, they're not going to be provoked. Now, having said that, we've got a new situation in the Middle East, which I think is very, very disturbing. And it seems to me that this could draw in into a wider conflict, particularly involving Israel, Hezbollah. Russia has got great interest in the area as well. China, again, is tending to sort of, she will work with Russia through the UN, but she won't do very much more. So really what we have until further notice is a situation where the dollar is killing itself. It's not the foreigners killing the dollar.
Yeah. It seems to me that what you're suggesting here then is that the Fed, if the Fed has to print all the money, the Fed has to keep printing in order to finance the U.S. deficit, there's going to be a loss of confidence somewhere in the markets and the financial markets. They're going to start to see what is really going on, and they're not going to want to hold dollars anymore. They're not going to hold treasuries, I guess. And then if you continue to drive interest rates lower, and Mr. Bernanke yesterday was weighing in with his notion that we should actually go into negative rates, and you had pointed out on this show before what that would mean for the world's reserve currency, very bearish for the world's reserve currency because of this whole notion of time preference. So those dynamics seem to be very much in order. I mean, if the Fed had to come in and buy 90% of our treasuries since September, it means they had to do that in order to keep interest rates suppressed so that the whole thing wouldn't fall apart, right?
Well, I think more importantly, they have to do it to keep the U.S. government funded. That's uh-huh. the real problem. Uh-huh. But getting back to the basic theme of what you were saying, I think that this year is the year when the frailty of the fiat money system is going to be exposed to the markets. I mean, we're already seeing this in the gold price. I mean, the action in COMEX is really quite extraordinary. I mean, we've got open interest has rocketed up to nearly 800,000 contracts. The highest we ever had it before was 630,000 contracts. Mm. And that was regarded as extreme. I mean, you know, if you were getting over 500,000 contracts not too long ago, that was a pretty overbought market. Now we're at 800,000. We must not forget that each contract has a short and a long. So if there are 800,000 contracts outstanding, then that is roughly 2,500 tons of short positions. There are also long positions against it as well. But to me, one of the great clues in the last quarter of last year was at the very end of November, when the December contract was rolling off the board, there was one day where there was a switch from the December contract into the next active contract of 110,000 contracts. I've never seen such a large single-day movement. And, you know, until that happened, I thought, my goodness, we're sitting on a precipice here. But there's obviously a whale in there with a huge, great position. Now, mm-hmm. that whale does not have a position which presumably approximates to 10 million ounces. You know, that is something you do not do unless you have some very, very good information or you are absolutely confident in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Now, this was happening basically just as the repo business was beginning to go wrong. Now, that mm-hmm. tells me that there are players in the market, insiders who really do understand what's happening. And the reason that the bullion banks haven't bashed the market back to try and shake out speculators as stop losses get triggered and all the rest of it is, you know, the buyer is in there absorbing anything on any dip. And sure enough, I mean, it was okay. We had this Iranian thing over last weekend, which drove the price up briefly to 1580 or 1590 or something. Mm-hmm. But even if that had not happened, the way the gold market was going, it was telling us that there's something very, very wrong in the fiat currency world. I see this continuing, and I would sum it up by saying 2020 is going to be a year of discovery for those who think that fiat currencies are all tickety-boo and it's all going to be wonderful.
Well, Alistair, that's a lot of gold and a lot of paper gold contracts. If people start to demand delivery, what's going to happen to the gold market?
Well, I'm not sure they'll start demanding delivery. I think we're looking at hedge funds. We're looking at very, very big dealers in paper, basically. And I think they'll just roll their positions as long as they wish. Mm-hmm. They'll probably wind it down at some stage during the year. But I think the whole thing is changing so rapidly, there is a growing appreciation, I think, in the investing public that there is something wrong with the dollar. And if the dollar starts going down, as the technical analysis suggests, mm-hmm. then I can see real blood in the streets. The other aspect of this, which we haven't touched on at all, of course, is what happens to bond yields. Mm-hmm. I think bond yields are going to rise this year, and I can easily see the 10-year government bond yield rising to over 3, 4, possibly even 5%. Wow. Now, if that happens, then basically U.S. government finances are screwed.
Yeah. Well, indeed. I mean, the Powell pivot took place when rates were rising below, I don't know, I don't think the 10-year got to 4% or did it? I don't think so. So, I mean, then, you know, the equity market started having real problems before tons of money was pumped in there by Mr. Powell. So, Alistair, with just about a minute and a half left, you wrote an article, Gold's Outlook for 2020. I think you just touched on it. But could you give us a real quick summary of what that article is? And then people, of course, can go to Gold Money and read the entire article.
Yes, it's all about the effect of inflation on fiat currencies, particularly the dollar, and the way the dollar is going to get hit, if you like, in terms of its purchasing power. I think 2020 is the year when this really becomes very, very obvious. The other thing I did in that article is a lot of people tell me that higher interest rates are bad for gold. I illustrate in that article why higher interest rates are not bad for gold. Mm-hmm. And I particularly focus on a situation which I think is very similar to the one we face now. And that is what we faced in the UK between 1970 and 1974, when bond yields on the long end rose from something like 7% to, I can't remember offhand, but it's something like 11 or 12%. And at the same time, gold rose from £14 to £80. Mm-hmm. Are higher bond yields bad for gold? No, they are not.
Well, and indeed, I mean, again, another issue where you and Michael Oliver are in agreement with on, and that is the potential for rising treasury rate markets this year. We'll have to leave it go at that. Alistair, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. And people, just go to goldmoney.com to read Alistair's weekly essays there. They're very, very important and very insightful in helping you understand what's really going on in the financial markets. Thank you so much, Alistair. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, we're going to have David Rosenberg with us. That's some people call him Canada's most famous economist. And also, I'll be introducing Sitka Gold Corp. It's a new sponsor to the show and a company that I'm very, very bullish on, and one that I have purchased shares in for myself and also have recommended in our newsletter. So that is all for this week. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Lion One Metals, one of 2019's top-performing gold stocks, is geared for aggressive growth in 2020. With drilling already underway at its fully permitted high-grade Tuvatu Gold Project in Fiji, one of the last high-grade gold deposits of its kind anywhere in the world, now owned by a major gold mining company, Lion One trades in the USA on the OTCQX under the symbol LOMLF and in Canada under LIO on the TSXV. To learn more about Lion One's world-class high-grade gold potential in Fiji, go to liononemetals.com.